From the Centre for Public Christianity, you're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Natasha Moore.
Well, the relationship between religion and the media in the West has a long history. In fact, they were intertwined from the start. The first newspapers were often printed on the very same presses that were used to publish Bibles. And the first radio broadcast on Christmas Eve in 1906 included this.
And lo, the angel of the Lord came upon them, and the glory of the Lord shone round about them, and they were sore afraid. And the angel said unto them, Fear not, for behold, I bring you good tidings of great joy, which shall be to all people. For unto you is born this day in the city of David a Saviour, which is Christ the Lord.
Times have certainly changed. If you look at the media landscape today, there's not a lot of room for religion. And when there is, more often than not, the coverage leans towards stereotypes and oversimplification.
There's a book that offers some really telling illustrations of this. It's called Blind Spot, When Journalists Don't Get Religion. And the authors tell the story of how in 2002, terrorists entered the offices of a charity in Karachi, and they picked out and murdered seven Christian workers and spared their Muslim colleague. But CNN International reported that there was no indication of a motive. And as the authors point out, would it have said the same thing if armed men had invaded a multiracial centre, separated the black people from the white people, and then methodically killed all the blacks and spared all the whites? This blind spot matters.
To guide us through the world of religion in the media and what's missing, we've enlisted a couple of experts. Later, a New York Times reporter explains why he took a year off to literally search for God at Harvard. But first, we'll hear from an Australian journalist who is a fierce advocate for good religious reporting and a senior fellow with the Centre for Public Christianity, Barney Schwartz. Barney was the religion editor at Melbourne newspaper The Age for more than 10 years.
Recently, he wrote a fabulous opinion piece for ABC Religion and Ethics on religion in the media, looking back over a long career in the field and thinking about how it's changed and where it's headed. So we invited Barney onto Life and Faith to tell his story.
How's that?
That's fine. So I've already started recording, so just...
Okay, well, if I do anything badly, we'll just do that bit again. All right. Here I go. Journalists are not generally held in high esteem by society, and there are good reasons for that. But the fact remains that without journalism, Australia would be in a much less satisfactory place than it is now. Journalism is just essential for the safeguarding of democracy. We are Ezekiel's watchmen on the walls. We are the ones who uncover corruption, bad behaviour, dishonesty, self-aggrandizement, and all the things, especially that governments would like us not to know. If journalists aren't out there fighting for it, then Australians will never know it. The sort of problems that journalists have are the sort of problems that human beings have. We can be lazy, we can stereotype, we can sensationalize, we can look for things that are too convenient, we can be less than full in our reporting, we can be selective. I started off as a proofreader at the Evening Post in Wellington, and the chief reader was assigned to me because I was a newbie, and he had no teeth, and he was a racing fanatic. So we got all the racing stories, the scratchings, the fields, the stories, and he would, got that, Barney? Yes, Bill. And then there would be mistakes because I hadn't got it at all, and I would always be in trouble. Then I went to journalism school, and we did shorthand and typing and lots of journalistic subjects. And I had nothing but contempt for shorthand and typing. They were secretarial skills. Within 3 months of getting out into journalism, I realised they were the only useful things that I had learned that have stood me in good stead for 40 years. I got my first job at the Daily Telegraph in Napier because my then wife was a very good reporter who had worked very hard, and the chief reporter wanted another reporter who could play cricket, which I did, though not to a very high standard. After a few years in New Zealand newspapers, I came across to the Melbourne Herald. I went backpacking for a year and a half, and then I joined the Melbourne Age, and I spent 34 years there. I was special projects editor, opinion editor, letters editor, chief sub-editor, page one editor, and my last 12 years I was religion editor, and that was the best job I ever had. I applied for it because I wanted a change at the time. It was traditionally given to a junior reporter to test them out for real rounds, like industrial relations or education or city, and they were quite surprised when they got an application from this grizzled old hack. But I told them that they were only covering three stories, which were a troglodyte church gets in the ways of women and gays, the church is dying, and abusive priests. And of course, all these are important stories and we should be telling them. But if that is all we're talking about when we talk about religion, then we're missing something vital and exciting as part of Australian life and culture. And they agreed and they appointed me, and it was a really happy time. I got the opportunity to cover all sorts of stories. When I began, of course, I knew something about the Christian religion. I have a degree in theology, and I've been a practicing Christian for some time, but I knew very little about other areas. When I started, I knew two Muslims. They were both in the newsroom with me. By the time I finished, I knew several hundred. Besides the big religions of the monotheistic religions of Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, I wrote about Baha'is, Wiccans, Zoroastrians, Sabaean Mandaeans, Mormons, religious extremism, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, why interfaith harmony is stronger in Melbourne than it is in Sydney, religious festivals from all sorts of religions, church opposition to the Iraq War. That was one of my nicest memories. Before the 2004 Iraq War, the Anglican bishops and the Grand Mufti in Melbourne, Sheikh Fahmy, had a joint prayer, and the Anglicans prayed as Anglicans do, gently and nicely, and Sheikh Fahmy came on, and this quiet, small man suddenly became really impassioned. Oh, Lord, smite the evildoers! Bring them to perdition! And, and the Anglican bishops were watching on, shifting uneasily from foot to foot. There were lots of nice, gentle memories like that that come out of a round like this. I often felt, when I was covering religion, that the people I was writing about expected me to manipulate things a little bit to make Christianity look good. Also, I felt very strongly that the best way to honour God in this role was to be as fair and accurate a reporter as possible, to tell the truth, to try and get things balanced. To argue for God would be to betray God, I felt. It's a source of pride to me that for the first 3 years, people had no idea where I was coming from. People who didn't know me did not know whether I was a believer or not. I was always expected to write about religion as though it were a politics story, with winners and losers and fights. And sometimes that's right, and sometimes it's not. The technical language of religion. If you've got 300 words to tell a story, and you've got to spend 100 of them in backgrounding who people are and what that actually means in plain English, that requires special skills, perhaps, which sometimes I didn't always have, because the news editor would say, you haven't done that very well, Barney. But it's very, very important that I was not seen to be an evangelist or a proselytizer or an advocate. What I brought that was valued was a background knowledge of the subject, a background knowledge of how churches operate and how Christians think. Of course, I made mistakes, and I learned a great deal as I went on.
Barney, how are you?
Hi, Simon. Yeah. Great to see you.
Yeah, nice to see you.
Recently, I caught up with Simon Mann. He was the deputy editor of The Age when I was there, and a distinguished correspondent, and he remains a good friend. Given that we've both left the world of newspapers, I was wondering what he thought about how the papers are going these days, and in particular how religion is covered now. But of course, when old friends catch up, we had a few general comments to make.
You are looking very well.
So are you. You reciprocated quickly.
So, Simon, what were your initial thoughts when I applied for the religion reporter's post?
From memory, we didn't have a religious affairs reporter at that point. I don't know how it came to be that we didn't have a religious affairs reporter, but as you well know, newsroom roles seem to evolve, change, get dropped, picked up again, reinvented. So I guess we're in that reinventing phase. And it struck me that it was a real deficit in our news coverage that we didn't have a dedicated religious affairs writer, editor, reporter. And the fact that somebody with great knowledge in that area and a commitment to that, covering that area, was applying was terrific.
I was faintly surprised. I was on a panel with Michael Gwender a couple of years ago, and he said that he was a bit concerned about giving to somebody who was religious. Why do you think that was, and how did you feel about that?
I think Michael might be sort of overplaying that a little bit, because he, like myself, we were both concerned, and he was the boss, of course. It took no time to convince him that we needed coverage of that area. But I suppose he'd be reticent, like most editors. If you wanted an environment reporter, my argument is that you wouldn't want somebody who was a card-carrying member of the Greens or had been working with one of the big sort of green advocacy groups. And he was a stickler for that sort of separation.
One of the things I was really grateful for when I began this round was how supportive you were, Simon, because as you well know, what really counts is what happens at 5 o'clock at news conference. That determines what actually gets into the paper that night. And if you're measuring two or three stories of similar value, then it's really helpful to have somebody important in your corner. And you were particularly supportive, and I'd like to take the opportunity to thank you for that.
12 years too late, Barney.
That's about 16 years too late.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Are there any stories of mine that you particularly remember?
Well, that puts me on the spot. The obvious thing would be the stories around abuse in the Catholic Church and the Church more generally. Obviously, you were strong in that area. But I think... stories around the sort of Muslim communities in Australia were very interesting. And I think they were also very helpful. Any good reporting which sort of opens a window into somebody else's world is very helpful. It sort of breaks down barriers. It allows people to see people in their true light. And I think that was very helpful. So there are a couple of things that come to mind.
Yes, I thought it was important, actually, with the Muslims. They were being so demonised. I took on the round, as you recall, just after 9/11. Yeah. And there was such widespread anger and suspicion that I did feel that we should work hard to just present them as ordinary people, which the vast majority of them are, of course. And The Age did a very good job of that. Not only me, the paper as a whole. Do you regret now that the sort of standard of religion reporting in this country, that there is nobody who's dedicated to it, apart from a couple of people at the ABC?
I think it's sad that there aren't more dedicated religion reporters, the same way that I'm sad about a lot of the developments in mainstream media, which have sort of been brought on by the digital revolution, the breakdown of the business models and all those things. I understand that those newsrooms are under such incredible stress. I get that, and I feel kind of anxious for former colleagues who are still on that treadmill working incredibly hard. I think it does require leadership in newsrooms to make sure that the coverage of religion continues in some shape or form. So I think it's a terrible indictment of leadership that it's not being covered more closely by mainstream media.
Yes, I'm pretty sad about it too. Perhaps just like when I started, the lack of religion reporting is part of a newsroom cycle, but I don't think so. If I'm honest, I think the great days are gone and they're not coming back anytime soon.
Do I have hope? Well, it's always good to remain hopeful, isn't it? I'm not quite sure how reporting of religious affairs and religious matters in mainstream media is going to be reinvigorated. I think probably what will happen is that there'll be more specialist reporting, which is happening. You know, the sort of disintegration of mainstream media and the rise of all these specialist websites and startups. I mean, you know, perhaps we'll get to the point in the cycle where it makes sense to have a startup that devotes itself to reporting of religious affairs broadly, not just in one faith, but across all the faiths. And perhaps it's already out there and I'm just not aware of it.
When I was appointed in 2002, there were very capable religion reporters on other papers. The Sydney Morning Herald had Kelly Burke and the Australian had Jill Robotham. But by the time I finished in 2012, for some years I've been joking in speeches that I was far and away the best mainstream religion reporter in the country, and also far and away the worst, because I was the last man standing. It's interesting that in Australia we spend so little attention on something that is so socially important, and important in terms of policy too, if you look at the influence of religion in schools and universities and charities. And when I went to Rome in 2005 to cover the conclave that elected Pope Benedict, I think there were half a dozen Australians, and most of those were European correspondents who'd been sent across from London. And contrast that with Americans. The Vatican Press Office told me there were hundreds and hundreds, in the thousands, of American reporters representing newspapers, television stations, networks, agencies. It was just a big story, and they recognised it, and we didn't. What's the effect of this? Does it really matter? I think it does, because religion is at the bedrock of the values and priorities and attitudes of vast numbers of Australians. Even those who are lapsed still admit that they're shaped by their Catholic upbringing or their Christian upbringing or their Muslim upbringing. If we ignore that, we get a false picture of what Australia is like. And I think we do have, in fact, a false picture. We tend to think Australians are far more secular than they really are. We don't like religion thrust down our throat, but as Hugh Mackay pointed out in his recent book, Beyond Belief, 88% of Australians want a church in their neighbourhood, even though they have no intention of going. If there is a good religion report in the future, I fear it will be a matter of luck. It will be a matter of finding somebody who's really interested, who's knowledgeable, who can do it engagingly, and whom the media organisation for whom he or she works is prepared to allow the time to do that. In other words, media organisations have to see again that it is important. Now, that could happen if there's religious violence breaks out or if there is more terrorism, but that's not the sort of religion reporting that I want to see, because who wants to have anything as a result of a terrorist attack? Of course, I could be as wrong about that as I've been wrong about many other things in my long and indistinguished career. I'd like to leave you with three quotes that have sustained me throughout my career in journalism. The first is from Noel Coward. "It's discouraging how many people are shocked by honesty and how few are shocked by deceit." The second comes from Something Happened, a novel by Joseph Heller that I read, I don't know, 30 years ago. And it's very wise. It says, "Every change is for the worse." If you think that's a little bit pessimistic, then I offer you Dan Quayle, the former Vice President of the United States, who said, "The future will be better tomorrow." And that's wise too, isn't it?
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. If you've just joined us, we're talking about religion coverage in the media and why it matters that it's done well.
We've just heard from Australian journalist, our colleague Barney Schwartz, and now we cross the Pacific with our producer Karen Tong, who brings us a story from New York, the story of a reporter who left his job to search for God at Harvard.
Tell me a little bit about the course that you teach.
Okay, sure. My name is Ari Goldman. I'm a professor at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism, and my area of specialty is religion.
Professor Goldman is leaning back in his chair behind a desk that is almost comically littered with piles of papers and books. Titles include Religions in South Asia, Jerusalem, and Beyond Sectarianism. The bottom edge of his computer is lined with yellow post-it notes, and there's a fan humming in the background that neither of us know how to switch off. I have to ask Ari to lean forward so I can hear him better.
Religion, whether you're writing about politics or healthcare or international affairs, we often stumble into the religion story, and reporters often don't understand religion, and I try to prepare my students for writing about it in a smart way.
I was curious to know where this passionate commitment to understanding religion came from.
Oh boy. Okay, where do I start? I had some turmoil as a child. My parents were divorced, but as different as my parents were, the thing that they had in common was a belief in traditional Judaism. And Orthodox Judaism became almost like a home for me, a place that was familiar, a place that was constant, steady, had certain way of life and rituals that were very comforting and unifying for me. So I've always taken my faith very seriously because it's a foundation for my life.
It was the foundation for his work as well, as a reporter for the New York Times.
For me, religion was inescapable. It's such a big story in our culture, in our society, in our democracy. There's like no end to religion stories, it seems. And while I was a reporter for many years writing about politics and education, transportation, I had a lot of different beats when I was a reporter. I've found writing about spiritual matters most satisfying. I did many stories about religion and politics. And I'm going to take us back to more than 30 years when Geraldine Ferraro was running for vice president of the United States in 1984. She was a Catholic who was pro-choice. And the Cardinal Archbishop of New York, John O'Connor, said you cannot be a Catholic and be pro-choice, that there's no diversity of opinion when it comes to abortion. Catholics believe one thing. And this became a very big fight between the Catholic Church and Democratic politicians, even to the point where some of the Catholic prelates were saying that you can't give communion to Catholic politicians who are pro-choice. So this is a debate that goes back that we're seeing in some ways relive today with another female pro-choice candidate. And how does the Catholic Church embrace her or reject her? What was a very big issue 30 years ago is not a big issue today. it seems that the focus of the church is somewhat different, and you don't get the same kind of criticism. But back in the 80s, it was a big fight.
Ari decided to take a year off from reporting on religion to spend the year examining it. He writes about this experience in his book, The Search for God at Harvard.
Now, you could spend a lifetime studying any one religion, you know, learning about Christianity or Islam or Judaism or Buddhism or Hinduism. I only have one lifetime, but I decided that if I spent a year familiarizing myself with those traditions and learning the rituals and who the leaders, that I'd have places to go back when I was reporting and ask questions. And I think that's what a reporter needs to do, needs to know enough to ask good questions. So I spent a year learning world religions, and that gave me a foundation for reporting about them.
And you write about in your book a wanting not only to know what people from other religious backgrounds are thinking, but what they're feeling. And a lot of these insights actually came not from the classroom, but from the people that were in class with you, talking with them and sharing life with them. So can you tell me maybe one or two insights that you had into perhaps religions that are not your own?
So much of the ritual that I'm accustomed to involves a lot of talking and a lot of singing and a lot of praying, frankly, a lot of noise and a lot of turmoil. And being able to join a Buddhist meditation where the way that one becomes enlightened is not through talking and discussion and debate, but just through silence, was a revelation for me. And trying to find those moments of quiet, of contemplation, was somewhat new.
Is this something that you feel has sort of carried on? Do you look for moments of silence now?
I do try to make space for more meditation, more silence, more contemplation. And that's on the one hand. On the other hand, being in a African-American revival service where there's a lot of joy and a lot of singing and a lot of music and a lot of instruments, that's something also that is different from my own experience, but that I can relate to, I can tap into, and I can find some religious meaning in.
These experiences helped him become a better journalist as well.
There's a wonderful term. Journalists are supposed to be objective. And objective takes you away from the experience of others. But there's this idea called empathetic objectivity, where you can be objective, you're outside, but you also do your best to understand the experience of the insider. And in order to do that, you need to understand that person's symbols. And when I say symbols, I mean a whole host of things, the way that they tell stories, the way that they eat, the language that they use, the ritual practices. And once I begin to understand your symbols, I can come close to approximating what it's like to be inside of your religious belief. And I can enter into that world. I can empathize without joining your church or your mosque or your faith. I know where I come from, yet I'm open to your practice and your beliefs. And as a journalist, I can write about them in a way that you'll recognize. Not in a way, oh, he's an outsider, but an outsider who is empathetic.
This ability, empathetic objectivity, is something that he teaches his students at Columbia University. Ari sends students out to a church, a mosque, and a synagogue, and asks them to describe a ritual, but not from their own perspective as an observer, rather from the point of view of the believer.
So one student wrote about crossing yourself when you walk into church and how you hold your hand and the motions from your head to your chest, to the right to the left. And just describing, the student stood in front of a church, and it's a Catholic church, and watched people cross themselves and described the motions and the look on their face. Now, some people do that almost as a reflex. But then the student asked people to stop and talk about what that means to them. One woman said, "When I cross myself, I'm entering into a conversation with God. And when I walk into the church, I'm here just to talk to God. I'm not here to talk to anybody else. And then when I leave, I cross myself again, and then I exit that conversation." And I just thought that was very, very beautiful, because we've all seen people cross themselves when they go through the threshold. But for this woman, it had a special meaning, and she was able to share that, and we were able to describe it. Just tell you one more. In Judaism, in the Friday night service welcoming the Sabbath, the believer, at a certain point in the service, turns around, faces the door, and bows. And that happens in synagogues every Friday night. And you watch this motion, and you think, well, they're bowing. Are they greeting other people? Are they greeting God? What is that about? If you ask for the detail, you find out that they're turning and welcoming the Sabbath bride. So the Sabbath begins, and rather than just pray, you stop the prayer, you turn to the door, you welcome the Sabbath bride, and you bow. Another lovely idea that religion has this force that's personified as brides, as angels, as in encounters with God. When you begin to break down people's beliefs, you see the texture, you see the richness, and you see the beauty. And that's what I want my students to see and what I want them to write about.
These stories of students engaging with religions, it sounds beautiful, but I can't help but feel that they are so far removed from how religion is represented in the media today.
To me, it feels far less beautiful and far less poignant.
Right.
Can you tell me, what are your thoughts on this, on the current representation of religion in the media?
We all too often fall into stereotypes about religion and about religious people. We sort of brand them as extremists, as believers, as non-believers, as heretics. We have language that minimizes them and caricatures them. And that is dangerous. And it's dangerous because it just feeds into people's negative stereotypes. It's important to show religious people for not who we think they are, but who they are. As long as we stand in opposition, and as long as we look at people and say they're the other, then we will take this stand, which I think is really grounded in fear. But once we say they have a point of view and it's worth exploring, worth understanding where they come from and how they believe, that's the beginning of some real religious understanding and connection. I think that we fail all too often to get to that deeper meaning and to that texture, but I think it's our obligation to try to understand on a deeper level.
As people who do consume the news on a daily basis, and we're taking in a lot of news that does cover religion, how can we improve our religious literacy, and how will this actually benefit us individually, so personally, as well as a society?
There's so much fear about religion. In the United States in particular, a lot of fear about Islam. And I think if Americans had access to mosques and could see what was happening in mosques, they would know these are not training grounds or recruiting grounds. These are people who pray just like Christians do and Jews do and Buddhists and Muslims do and Hindus do. They're people who have practices, and we have to understand those practices and understand these are people much like us. We have to do this without being naive and saying, you know, that there's no such thing as radical Islam, because there is radical Islam, because there are radical Jews and radical Christians, and we have to be aware that religion can be perverted to particular ends, but we need to know the difference between religion that's corrupted and religion that is presented in its proper form and in a form that enriches people's lives. So much of religion is good, and we just constantly are reporting on the religion that's bad. So what I try to do is tell the good religion story without ignoring the bad one, but putting it all in perspective. And I think that's our responsibility as journalists and as citizens, just to know the difference. You know, there are restaurants that we like to go to and restaurants that we don't go to. And there's a health warning at the restaurants that are bad or dangerous, or we're going to get food poisoning. Likewise, I think there are religious institutions that are good for people, and there are those that are harmful and damaging. But we should be able to know the difference. And I think intelligent, sophisticated readers, consumers, and citizens have an obligation to know the difference.
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you've been listening to Life and Faith with Simon Smart and Natasha Moore. If you enjoyed hearing from Barney Schwartz and Ari Goldman and want to hear more conversations like this, you can subscribe to Life and Faith on iTunes. Just type CPX in the search box to find us. While you're there, do us a favour and leave us a rating or review. It helps other people discover our podcast. We look forward to your company next week on Life and Faith.